Just launch right in? Okay. Good morning. Please join me in the invocation to the Srimad Bhagavatam. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Was that three times? Supposed to be three times responsively, but depends on which state educational system you're involved with. My name is Joshua Green. I was initiated by Srila Prabhupada's Yogeshwara back in '03, I think it was. 1970, I was initiated. You do the math. I have no idea how old I am. By the way, I'm notorious for jokes. And people ask me, are you funny? And I say, no, it's not that kind of humor. So if you can kind of just breathe through those parts, we'll get along just fine. How many of you are actively in classes here at the university? How many of you are inactively involved in your classes? That's never mind. Okay, so I've been told to moderate my, modify my presentation here, because not all of you have yet achieved the stage of Savikalpa Samadhi, and so I need to take that into consideration. We're reading from the seventh canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Do you read the verse or just get into the translation? Yeah, sure. Okay, seventh canto, chapter 7. Text 42, so line by line, let me do it. Sukhaya dukkha mokshaya.
Sukhaya dukkha mokshaya.
Sankalpa iha karmina.
Sankalpa iha karmina.
Sadapnoti haya dukkham. Anihaya sukhavrata.
Anihaya sukhavrata.
Sukhaya dukkha mokshaya.
Sukhaya dukkha mokshaya.
Sankalpa iha karmina.
Sankalpa iha karmina.
Sadapnoti haya dukkham.
Sadapnoti haya dukkham.
Anihaya sukhavrata. Ask for volunteers? Anyone daring enough to launch in and give it a try? Sukhaya dukkha mokshaya. Sankalpa iha karmina. Sapnoti haya dukkham. Anihaya sukhavrata. Very nice. Who was that? I didn't see you. There you are. You're hiding. What's your name?
Sashi.
Sashi. Nice to meet you. Thank you very much. Anyone else? Extra credit.
Sukhaya dukkha mokshaya.
Sukhaya dukkha mokshaya. Sankalpa iha karmina. Sapnoti haya dukkham. Anihaya sukhavrataha. Next time you can slow it down a little and savor each syllable. It's quite relishable. Take your time with it. But nicely done. What's your name?
Petit?
Pratik. Pratik. Nice to meet you. Alright. Anyone else or are we done here? Sukhaya dukkha mokshaya. Sankalpa iha karmina. Sadapnuti haya dukkham. Anihaya sukhavrita. What's your name? Are you available for Mridanga classes? That was awesome. Gee whiz. Say your name again. Shyamala Kishori Dasi. Nice to meet you. Okay, Sukaya, for achieving happiness by a so-called higher standard of life. Dukkha Mokshaya, for becoming free from misery. Sankalpa, the determination. Iha, in this world. Karmina, of the living entity trying for economic development. Sada, always. Apnoti, achieves. Ihaya, by activity or ambition. Dukkham, only unhappiness. Anihaya, and from not desiring economic development. Sukha, by happiness. Avrita, covered. Translation, in this material world, every materialist desires to achieve happiness and diminish his distress. And therefore, he acts accordingly. Actually, however, one is happy as long as one does not endeavor for happiness. As soon as one begins his activities for happiness, his conditions of distress begin. Rather counterintuitive, isn't it? So we'll get into that. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Every conditioned soul is bound by the laws of material nature. As described in the Bhagavad Gita, prakrite kriyamanani gunai karmani sarvasha. Everyone has achieved a certain type of body given by material nature according to the instructions of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Ishvara sarvabhutanam prijeshi arjuna tishtati brahmayan sarvabhutani yantra rudrani mayaya. The Supreme Lord is situated in everyone's heart, O Arjuna, and is directing the wanderings of all living entities who are seated as on a machine made of the material energy. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Supersoul, is present in everyone's heart. And as the living entity desires, the Lord gives him facilities with which to work according to his ambitions in different grades of bodies. The body is just like an instrument by which the living entity moves according to false desires for happiness, and then suffers the pangs of birth, death, old age, and disease in different standards of life. Everyone begins his activities with some plan and ambition. But actually, from the beginning of one's plan to the end, one does not derive any happiness. On the contrary, as soon as one begins acting according to his plan, his life of distress immediately begins. Therefore, one should not be ambitious to dissipate the unhappy conditions of life, for one cannot do anything about them. Ahankara vimudatma kartaham iti manyate. Although one is acting according to false ambitions, he thinks he can improve his material conditions by his activities. The Vedas enjoin that one should not try to increase happiness or decrease distress, for this is futile. Tasyaiva hetu prayateta kovida. One should work for self-realization, not for economic development, which is impossible to improve. Without endeavor, one can get the amount of happiness and distress for which he is destined, and one cannot change this. Therefore, it is better to use one's time for advancement in the spiritual life of Krishna consciousness. One should not waste his valuable life as a human being. It is better to utilize this life for developing Krishna consciousness without ambitions for so-called happiness. Okay, so I tell my student, by the way, let me just give you a quick overview, right? 62 years in 60 seconds. I'm a New Yorker, or I guess I should pronounce it properly. I'm a New Yorker. And I joined Krishna Consciousness in London in 1969 when I was 19 years old and stayed in temples for 13 years. Came out, it was October of 1982, so the entire period of the 70s was a loss. Whatever happened during that decade, I have no idea. Bruce Springsteen, who is he? I don't know. And came back and... you know, after 13 years looking for work, you know, like most soldiers coming back from war. And, you know, what skills did I have to offer? Fervent prayer? I mean, you know, why would a company hire me? So naturally, I went into public relations. Did some interesting things in that arena with religious communities, faith groups, hooking them up with corporations looking to improve their public image and so on. And then 9/11 happened, and the company just dismissed 3/4 of its staff. So naturally, the next place for me was academia. And so now I'm a professor of religious studies at Hofstra University on Long Island. But what I really want to do is direct. No, I'm only kidding. On Tuesday evenings, I teach a Bhagavad Gita class at the Jiva Mukti Yoga School in New York, which is wonderful because the best I can get out of my students at Hofstra is, Professor Green, is this going to be on the final? At Hofstra, they're really hungry for knowledge. At Jiva Mukti, they're really hungry for knowledge. They don't need college credits. They're not there because they have to be there. You know, they come to talk about important things. So I'm hoping we're going to talk about some important things here. I'm going to yak. Here's how we're going to do this. I'll yak it up for a few minutes. And then we're just going to open this up to questions. Okay? Questions and comments. Is that fair? All right. Here's the deal. If at any point I use a word you don't know, raise your hand or, you know, throw a book or something. If I say something that's unclear, raise your hand. Ask a question. Don't just sit there passively accepting everything that I say because I'm sitting up front. If there's anything that's not clear, already every hand should be up. But we'll work on it. Okay. So where was I? Oh, yes, introductions. Hi, Harry Bowl. And my dear friend Kalakanta invites me to give a class sometime. So that's how we got here today. And my son's here too, Namamrita. And who's here? He's your boss? How does that work? Oh, he's on the board of directors. Ah, you got to do what he says. Yeah. Got it. See, what's interesting about this verse, of course, is that Prahlad went on to become a king and had all the stuff that he's telling all his classmates, don't do that. This is fascinating, right? He became opulent. Prahlad was an extraordinary king. You know, he engaged in battles. He had this wonderful kingdom, you know, great life. So how, it doesn't compute. Any ideas? Let's discuss. Yes. Say your name so that we can all get to know you. Tulsi Rani. My, beautiful. Thank you.
Can you please give the background of who Prahlad Maharaj is and how he was talking to his schoolmates, as you referenced?
Right. Does everyone? So not everyone knows who Prahlad is. Okay. Let's just get into that briefly. Thank you for that, Tulsi Rani. I'd like to say that name. There has not been a moment in recorded history when humanity has not been at war. Literally every moment in the history of the world has seen some kind of armed conflict. There have been more than 100 just within the past decade around the world. And that's been the case going back even to before recorded history. Now, the Bhagavatam originated at a time before formal archives. You cannot trace the Bhagavatam by reference to other texts or other references. It's self-referential in that sense. It gives its own history, but there's no such thing, for example, as the Dead Sea Scrolls in India. We don't have manuscripts going back that far. The sages wrote these texts on very perishable banana leaves and bark, which are subject to decay even just from exposure to weather. So there are very few ancient manuscripts existent that will attest to the historicity of these texts. And if you want to make an academic laugh, just tell him or her that every morning we're reading a book that's actually 5,000 years old. That's from within the tradition that that date originates. If you go to academia, they'll have a very different take on it based on linguistic assessments and so on. But there's no right or wrong in that arena because there's no way to achieve a conclusive opinion. So in these ancient texts, we have also evidence of conflict, warfare, conflagration going on throughout history. In most faith cultures, the wisdom texts codify those wars into two very distinct camps, the light and the dark, good and evil, you know, the righteous and the unrighteous, the suras and the asuras. And that's an easy way to point out a bad guy. The problem is that it's not very accurate. The United States during World War II was very united because the enemy was very clear. It was the Axis powers. It was Hitler and his cohorts. They're the bad guys. Let's go get them. It's become a little bit less clear these days. There was no such thing as terrorists in jurisprudence. You know, acts of terror were never pursued in a court of law prior to Guantanamo Bay. Prior to our invasion of Iraq, there was no such thing as terrorism as a crime. Yeah. In the world of law. So in the text, there is a fairly clear distinction. But your job is to read this text with a little bit more of a nuanced, close reading. Be cautious about falling into easy rhetoric of demons and demigods. There's no pure evil in anywhere, and there is no pure goodness anywhere. Everything in this world is a cocktail of qualities, mixtures in different varieties. And even if you read the story of Ramayana, when King Rama finally brings down Ravana, you know, and Hanuman is looking at the dead body of this king of the Rakshasas with contempt, Lord Rama sees him and says, no, don't. Had he been of a different nature, he could have been a very, very great ruler. Ravana, one of the great bad guys of all time. And here is Rama saying, no, except for his nature. He was a Rakshasa by nature. He wanted to be a Deva. He yearned to be a god. He yearned to be a demigod. He wanted nothing more in his life than to be like them. He understood that I'm of a race that's actually despicable. I have to take care of these people, but I hate it. He yearned to be a god. And he couldn't by his nature, psychologically, biochemically, genetically, emotionally. He could not be anything than what he was, which was a Rakshasa. So he stole Sita. If I can't be a god, at least I'll surround myself with the trappings of God. So be careful about too facile a division of the world into good and evil. Prahlad Maharaj was born of Hiranyakashipu, who was from the Asura side of that equation. He was from the demonic, if you will, the dark side. Well, what made him dark? He was a materialist. You know, he didn't have any spiritual aspirations. He loved his power. He loved his pleasures. In that sense, he really wasn't that different from most people we know, except on a larger scale. You know? He had this dark side to him, however. He was homicidal. I'll grant you that. He was, you know, there was something not quite working there. to the point where he wanted to kill his own son because he saw that his son was becoming a devotee. Does that ring any bells for anybody here? Yeah. Yeah, a somewhat different circumstance. There, the intent was to demonstrate one's love and loyalty to God's order. By the way, that story of sacrifice of Abraham is open for discussion, shall we say. The word in Hebrew for sacrifice can also be translated as to lift up. So it might have been that what God was ordering was lift up your son. Raise him as a devotee. But that's another class. Okay, where were we? Oh, you wanted to know about the background to Prahlad. Is that enough or do you need more? We haven't started. Yeah. Alright, basically he was in the womb of his mother and the Devas invaded Hiranyakashipu was off performing penances and austerities. He was out of town. So the gods took advantage of the moment to go and invade his kingdom, and they were taking everybody away, including Hiranyakashipu's wife, Prahlad's mother. She's pregnant with him. And then the message was conveyed. No. I think it was Narada Muni who conveyed. This is a great soul, and there's a pure devotee in her womb. Please leave her alone. Narada took her to his ashram and instructed her. And in the womb, there's evidence that you can hear that the infant in the womb is conscious of sound. I don't know if any of you were here for the George Harrison show we did. But I think I might have mentioned that when George was in the womb of his mother, George's sister, Louise, told me that their mom used to play a radio show on the BBC called All India. And it was ragas and kirtans. And so when George was in the womb, he was hearing Indian music. So when he, later on, when he was about 22 years old, when he first heard the music of Ravi Shankar, he said, it sounded familiar. Now, whether he was remembering something that he'd heard in his womb, the womb of his mother, or whether it was from some previous life, that we'll never know. But it did call to him. So we have a similar situation here where Prahlad is in the womb of his mother and he's receiving instruction from his teacher. So when he comes out, by the time he's 5 years old, he's already a Mahabhagavata, and he's instructing the other kids in his class, and now we are reading those teachings of Prahlad to his classmates. Does anyone else have a question that won't take 15 minutes to answer? How many of you, by the way, are going to college because your thinking is, this is going to get me a better job? Fess up. Raise your hand. Okay. So none of you are going to college because you think it's going to get you a better job. Huh? I guess so. Well, that shoots the whole point that I was about to make. You pretend that you're actually going to college. Yes, thank you. I have one. Yeah. Say your name so we can all get to know you.
My name's Gopal Das.
Hare Krishna.
In the purport it mentions something to the effect that you can't increase happiness or distress, it's destined. Mm-hmm. So it's related along those lines. And there's a line in the fifth canto by Prabhupada, and he says, we suffer and enjoy the effects in this life of the activities we performed in previous lives. Just like we'll enjoy or suffer the activities we're performing in this life in our next life, or if not later on in this life. You understand? So don't we have some free will in that way?
Yeah, there's this is why you shouldn't read this alone. Find a friend. Find a devotional friend and sit down and read it together or come to these classes, because it can be very confusing. Let me explain something. I use Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita in my classes at Jiva Mukti, but I have to tell everybody who comes, and I've got, I don't know how many people come. We've got a virtual community of downloads, something like 1,000 people, but who actually come to be there in the class, it may be between 15 and 50 people who come on Tuesdays. I tell everybody, look, we're using this Bhagavad Gita as it is because it has some extraordinarily important facets, qualities to it. You've got the synonyms, you've got translations, you've got the transliteration, you've got these wonderful commentaries. But bear something in mind. My spiritual master was born in the 19th century, not even the 20th century. He was born in the 19th century into British colonial India that was dominated by Christian missionary thinking. And sometimes some of that cultural influence spills over into the writing in his books. So you will come across a page in your reading of Prabhupada's books when all that you really want to do is close the cover and hurl it across the room. When you come to that page, don't do that. Just write the page number down, bring it to class, and we'll talk about it. Because I knew him personally, and I can tell you that everything can be resolved if you understood his nature, if you understood what he was really like. So sometimes in the reading, some of this may be intentional on his part, some of it may be, frankly, the fact that we were not always the best editors. You know, if I had been a little bit more on the ball, because I was fortunate to have a lot of time with him personally, I would have said to him, Srila Prabhupada, with all the love and respect that I have for you and for your mission, there's stuff we've got to change in these books. And I do not think that he would have said, who are you to speak to me in this way? He would have said, oh, show me where. As a matter of fact, I had this conversation with him. I remember in Paris, 1973, I guess, 73, 74, reading a verse in the Bhagavad Gita where it said, one who knows the body is called the knower of the field. Or words to that effect, and it sounded like that one who is enlightened is someone who thinks he's the body. It was confusing. So I went to him and I said, Srila Prabhupada, is this right? And I read it, and he said, read that again. I read it again. He said, no, that's wrong. That should be changed. So, you know, from my own experience, I can tell you, there are things. He would have been quite open. What is the impact of these words on its intended audience, on the intended readers? So just breathe through it. This is the first rule of yoga is breathe. And when those moments happen, just write it down and come, and we'll discuss it, okay? So now to your question, Gopal Prabhu. Karma is like a deck of cards. You're dealt a hand. Can't change the cards, but what you do with them, that's up to you. That's not my analogy. I forgot who first came up with that one, but it's fairly accurate. You cannot increase the amount of your happiness in life beyond a certain point, but you have no idea what that point is. You have no idea what your karmic allotment is in this life. Therefore, you've got to try. The whole message of Bhagavad Gita is get off your butt, Arjuna, and fight. Get up. What are you doing? No, this is my karma. No. I'll help you. So don't get caught in that bottleneck. That's a big mistake. Whoa, big. That's one of the big myths of Krishna consciousness, that you are the product of your karma. You know, that what happens to you in this lifetime, it's your karma. One of the huge myths with a capital M of Krishna conscious theology is that you know, you're ruled by karma. What happens to you in your life? Oh, I must have killed somebody in my last life because look at me now. You know, don't do that. Don't do that. Yeah. Say it again. Andy. Hi, Andy. Nice to meet you.
Hare Krishna. So I have a follow-on question. So what are the fruits? What's the result of thinking that way? What happens when we fall
thinking
into
which
that
way?
Myth? Thinking, believing the myth that you just said.
You become catatonic. You can't do anything. You can't possibly have any energy to make a full-hearted effort to move forward with whatever your projects are. I walked into Prabhupada, actually I didn't walk in, I sneaked in to Prabhupada's room, 70-some, I was young, is all I know. And, this was in London. And threw myself, because there was nobody guarding his door. You see, you can't just walk into Prabhupada's room, but there was nobody. So whatever. And, yeah. I came in, threw myself on the floor, started weeping like an idiot. And looked up and said, Srila Prabhupada, how can I advance in Krishna consciousness? What more can I do? He looked at me. He said, Utsaya, Nishtaya, Darya. Enthusiasm, keep company with the devotees, chant regularly. Looked at, is that all right? Yeah. He said, come here. So I kind of crawled over behind his desk and sat up next to him like a little puppy dog. And he took a garland off his desk and put it on my neck. And he said, you're very enthusiastic. He said, that will serve you well. He said, even materialists can't do anything without enthusiasm. He came to enthuse us to get out there and do something. That's, you know, in the Bhagavad Gita, in the 10th chapter, Krishna says, I am victory and adventure. Hello. So what is the consequence of thinking, well, I'm, you know, limited by my karma? You miss out. You miss out on the adventure. Yes. Your name, please. Jai Nitai Gauranga Das. What do your parents call you?
Go.
You have my sympathies. What's on your mind?
Just picking up with Prahlad again.
Was that a question?
No, I wanted to hear more about Prahlad.
To hear more about Prahlad? Well, Prahlad is he's one of the Mahajans. He's one of the great souls. He's an embodiment of devotional life, and his teachings to his classmates are revered as essential teachings on the path of bhakti, the path of devotion.
Prahlad first before was asked to give some background to Prahlad, and that was never continued. Prahlad was being introduced, and then Tulsi Rani. Not interrupted.
Well, you know, so his story, you're asking for Prahlad's story, is it? You want to know what he was teaching? Joe? Is that?
I think he
clarify your question for me. Help me to understand your question.
Gauralila Das, by the way.
Hare Krishna.
I think he was just pointing out the digression, and I think he wants to get back on track.
No, don't do that. No, that's not necessary. No, seriously. We talked about this last night. Anybody there last night? This is a really nice meeting at Manoram's home, where we got into a discussion of how your spiritual life unfolds in progressive stages, beginning with Vaidhi Bhakti, which is practice. You practice. And it's kind of like being a musician. Anybody here play music? That was the right question. Well, you know, you start with scales, right? What do you play? All sorts. You start with the basics, right? You got to learn the scales. You learn where the fingers go. You practice, practice, practice. How do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice, practice. And then eventually, once you've mastered those basics, then you can start to improvise. That's Raganuga Bhakti, spontaneous. Spontaneity is a very revered quality. So sometimes classes can be formal. And afterwards, if you want, I'll be happy to sit with you and we'll talk all about Prahlad Maharaj. So I'm not putting down your question. It's a wonderful question to ask more about Prahlad. What I'm saying is don't be prejudiced against the idea of a class sometimes being very spontaneous. That's also Krishna conscious. That's also valid. That also has a, if you will, a precedent in Vaishnav history. That, you know, when you get together in the company of fellow seekers, conversations can range far and wide. So this is more about what is of interest to you. What is of interest to the people in this room? I'm curious to get to know you. I want to know where you're at, what your interests are. If there's anything that's confusing, you may be asking yourself, how did I get here? How many of you recognize the reference? I have one hand, that's it? Two, okay. Oh, you're showing your age, you know. Right. David Byrne. Okay. So what would you like to know? Any questions? Yeah. Whatever you like. I can shoot you down just as quickly as I did the last one.
I had a question. This is a question I've had over the years. I mean, I've asked different people for their insight on it. And it's often we often hear how the spiritual world is unlimited, full of variety, endless variety, and definitely more variety than in this material world. But then when we read the descriptions of the pastimes and the different things that Krishna does and eats and stuff, it seems very direct, and this is it, and kind of, so I'm just wondering if you could explain that a little bit.
Wonderful question. Did everybody understand the question? That question was so wonderful, I have to ask the question whether you understood the question. That's a beautiful question. The spiritual world is unlimited, right? But when we read these pastimes and we read these activities, they seem rather constrained. This happened and this happened, right? This also came up, I think, a little bit last night. First thing, these books are all we have on this planet. On other planet, there are millions of Vedas. So we're constrained in one sense because the number of texts is limited on this particular planet at this particular time. But the knowledge is unlimited. On other planets, there's no end to it. So that's response number one. Response number two is be careful about judging the unlimited with a limited mind. We assess things by our own relative frame of reference. There's a phrase in Bengali, a jaundiced person sees everything yellow. So because our experience is that events have a beginning and a middle and an end, because we've grown up with linear time, we don't really have an intuitive understanding of eternal time, where things just expand unlimitedly. I'll give you another example from my own career in Krishna consciousness. Part of that being an enthusiastic young man was exchanging letters with Srila Prabhupada. And in one letter he said to me, you're very dedicated and enthusiastic, therefore you are going to go back to Krishna in the very near future. And then came the other shoe. It says, therefore, continue and do not slow down. He said, your spiritual life is like swimming in the ocean. You'll never find any end to it. Have you ever seen a Shakespeare play? Hamlet, Macbeth, whatever. Have you ever seen more than one version of a Shakespeare play? Huh? That's a what? No, thank God. Well, there are hundreds of staged versions of Hamlet, for example. You know, Laurence Olivier, Kenneth Branagh, I mean, you name it, you know, Richard Burton, gender-reversed Hamlets where he's played by a woman. There's all kinds of versions set in a contemporary. I was just reading something about Timon of Athens that's being done in London, set on Wall Street, because it's about greed. Right? It's the same play. It's the same words. Hundreds and hundreds of different versions. And each one is fascinating in its own way. Because each one is a different take, a different flavor, if you will, a different rasa. And the whole history of rasa theory began with Abhinavagupta, who was a theatrical commentator. When we talk about a lila or a pastime being eternal, it's only boring because you're thinking two-dimensionally. Inside that lila, the options for variety are limitless. You want one small example? I'll show you the difference in the same sentence just by changing a comma. The student said the teacher's a fool. The student, comma, said the teacher, comma, is a fool. Same words, two opposite meanings. So you might think about eternal lila in that way, that you limit the lila by your understanding of it at your own risk. And the more you progress spiritually, the more that inner world begins to reveal itself to you, the more the unlimited dimensions of that world will become clear. It's spontaneous. Devotional life is spontaneous. When you reach a point where you've conquered the... Okay, basics, guys, here's the basics. Keep your nose clean, be happy, chant your rounds. All right, that's the basics. Stick to those things. In time, you have my promise, you will see Krishna. It'll happen. But give it time. And the more you perform the basics, the more you distance yourself from harmful habits, you know what? That's not really going to do me any good. Let me suck it up and just put that aside. Let me stick to the straight and narrow here. Give it a try. After a while, when that becomes second nature, oh boy, that's when the good stuff starts happening. There was a... if we had time, I'd tell you. I don't know. I don't have time for all these stories. Stick to the basics. In due course, you'll get to those higher levels where these pastimes will reveal themselves. Okay. Yeah.
I know that you also are an author, an artist, and you talk about spontaneity. How can that... How does an artist, an author, capture spontaneity and put it in a form that, like a book or a work of art or something like that? How does that spontaneity, how do you guarantee that spontaneity is in that static object that you create?
Let me see if I understand your question. Saying when a writer writes a book, where does the spontaneity come in?
Well, he must be writing some inspiration or spontaneity in his view of the world. And wouldn't he or she want to capture that in the book or the work of art? And if so, then how do they do that?
Did you all get that? I'll try to answer that. It's a good question. First of all, a writer, like a musician, starts by learning the scales. You do your research. You conduct your interviews. You look at source materials. You read other versions of commentary or biography that someone else might have written so that you get a sense of what is the knowledge that's out there already, what's missing from that. So you have some bearing. Spontaneity is not without grounding in rigor. Spontaneity emerges from rigor and discipline. Spontaneity cannot happen without discipline except by becoming dangerous. So it's the same for a writer as it is for anyone else attempting to do something. And you will hear writers often say that, you know, it reached a point when I was developing this story where all of a sudden these characters came alive and I was just writing down whatever they were going to do. That's Krishna. What do I mean by that? What I mean by that is that sometimes we have a static image of Krishna as a top-down manager who's kind of spelled out all the rules. Your life is laid out for you. You just got to get with the program, right? And you're not really involved anymore. It's all been wound up and figured out before you came on the scene. You know, God's in control. That is not Krishna. Krishna is not the God of organized religion. Please don't make that mistake. Please don't make that mistake. God of organized religion, I personally find rather boring. Krishna, I can't get enough. Because what's happening there is that kind of spontaneity that animates art, that excites the imagination. It's the realm of possibility and potential. He says in the Bhagavad Gita, what he does not say in the Bhagavad Gita is, I'm in control of everything that you are going to do and say in your life. Here's the script. Just follow it. He never says that in the Bhagavad Gita. What he says is, I am the seed of things. Now, what is a seed? A seed is the potential for the future. It's not the future. It's the potential for the future. He uses that word often, like the word bija appears several times in the Gita. Right? And then at the end of the Gita, what does he tell Arjuna? He says, do what you think best. Doesn't say do it, you know, there are no thou shalt and thou shalt not in the Bhagavad Gita. It's not there. It's all about you coming into your own relationship with divinity from that place of spontaneity based in practice. So when Prabhupada used to say, first deserve, then desire, you might translate that as, first get the basics down. Before you try anything spontaneous, make sure you've got a good grounding. Otherwise, you're going to get into trouble. This is very powerful stuff. So make sure you're following the basics, and then gradually the spontaneous stuff will happen. How spontaneity can get us in trouble? Ask any of the thousands of people who started in Krishna consciousness and who are now gone. You know, I see people, as you all have in your own respective individual ways, connecting with this. This is not by mistake, by the way. This is quite marvelous. This is quite a beautiful thing that we, you know, how many people are there in Florida, you know, and there's how many of us in this room here right now? So we're here for a reason. And there's something quite extraordinary about that. But if you don't ground your understanding in a clear awareness of the meaning of the texts, the meaning of the philosophy, it can get very heady. You can get carried away with it. When you get into trouble is as soon as you start thinking, now I'm making some spiritual progress. That's when you're going to get into trouble. Because then you'll start taking chances and you'll start stretching the envelope, maybe trying a few things. I remember in Paris, we were in, George Harrison had a friend named Maxime. She had clubs in Paris and she wanted to throw a soiree for us, you know, to help raise money for a temple in Paris because she was George's friend. So Prabhupada was there and we went to talk with him about it, and he said, and I told him, I said, look, she wants us to meet her at her club in Montmartre at midnight on Friday night. Now, this club had mirrored floors, you know, and disco balls, dark lights, red spots, you know, the limos were lined up out front. Women with, you know, skirts so short they looked long by comparison with other short skirts. You know, I mean, just like whatever. And he looked at me for a minute and he said, well, go fishing, but don't get wet. Meaning, don't think yourself more advanced than you really are. And if you think that there's even the slightest chance that this is going to be dangerous, stay away. Wait, or come back and talk it over with people. If you have an idea, if it's a good idea, there's no harm talking it over and getting some confirmation from your associates, right? Yeah. Oh, yes.